Under certain circumstances, there are few hours in life more agreeable than the hour dedicated to the ceremony known as afternoon tea.
You don't know about
the circumstances in which, whether you partake of the tea or not,
the wind was nearly gone.
The situation is itself the only thing forward to the young man.
There was a father gave me strength a lot to come. He cared nothing for Barbara's sense. In fact, he disliked it. Secretary, are you getting all that?
Okay, so I am here with Cynthia Ozick, who is the author of Heirs of the Glimmering World, and most recently, Dictation. Cynthia, how are you doing today?
I'm well, thank you.
I should also say an early happy birthday to you.
Yes, now that is a problem for me.
Oh, really? Well, I know it's not polite to ask a lady her age, and so I won't dwell upon that. I just wanted to, whether you celebrate it or not, I just wanted to at least offer
the kind words
your way.
Thank you.
But first off, I actually wanted to ask you about Dictation, the title story. This was very interesting to me for a number of reasons, because here you have two writers, Henry James and Joseph Conrad, two secretaries of Henry James and Joseph Conrad, and then on top of that, you have a number of repetitions throughout the story, as if to kind of echo or beckon the typewriter, like in the very beginning, when you have Henry James describing Alemeyer's folly, he keeps saying, he saw. And there's a number of interesting things you do in the syntax in that story that almost echoes the typewriter. So I wanted to ask how this particular stylistic device came about. I know you spend a lot of time on your sentences, so you had to have at least been somewhat aware of this.
Well, not so much of the repetition in the repetition in consonance with the typewriter. No, I wasn't aware of that at all, and I'm rather taken aback by hearing you say, have you actually seen this, heard it? I have not. I have not. I'm sorry to disappoint, but I that is not what I had in mind. What I had in mind really was the joy of the mischief when it occurred to me. And the stylistic aspect had to do more, not with the sounds, that's what you're getting at, but with the tone and style of speech of these people in that era, particularly with the formality of the young ladies who must call each other Miss, and to venture into a first name is really quite forward and not to be countenanced by polite society at first. And also the great pleasure of my parodying of James and Conrad. Though, here's a confession, and having very much to do with style, I purloined certain phrases directly from the letters of James and Conrad. So there are sentences buried in there which are absolutely authentic because they're stolen directly. Not full sentences, but phrases here and there. So that gave me a lot of joy too, because it was a kind of imitation, mimicry, reflection of what these two amanuenses were up to in their mischievous plan.
I had a feeling, given the forgotten umbrella motif, because I know that Daisy Miller calls calls one of the characters basically an umbrella. When I first met you, you know this because I know you did your master's on this, but
Later novels.
Yes, yeah, on the later novels, but on the early ones.
Right.
But I'm wondering how the forgotten umbrella phrase came about. I mean, yes, it's obviously a trope, but I actually had a feeling that this was, given what you've just said, almost a phrase pilfered from Henry James. I mean,
I hadn't thought of that, but I'm delighted to hear I've pilfered something else. All this is about pilfering.
Yeah.
This whole thing is really a very wicked story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the other thing, I mean, and here's a really cockamamie way of reading this particular story, is I thought of it in terms of your essay in Harper's Literary Entrails, because here we have, in fact, the very opening line has "in the early summer of 2001. So I'm thinking 1901, sorry.
That's right.
I'm thinking a 21st century parallel here, because you have the typewriter
internet today. You have this great concern about what is the future of literature in light of this emerging technology. And so I was tempted to read it in light of many of your thoughts. And of course, you have book lovers wondering, well, literature, is it going to die because of technology and the like?
Yes.
I'm wondering if literary entrails and dictation were written more or less in tandem with each other, or if whether similar thoughts went into both essay and story. Maybe you can elaborate upon this.
Well, they ran parallel somewhat in the writing, not fully parallel, but generally within the same few years. 2 years, perhaps. And whether one reflected on the other is a marvelous question, because here we are now, and I'm more or less the way Queen Victoria was. I invented this, by the way. I have no idea whether Queen Victoria had a secretary, as this story states, who absolutely refused to take on the new technology of the typewriter.
Yeah.
But here I am visiting with you, and it's going to be a podcast, and I feel very much like Queen Victoria's secretary.
I feel so, like I can burn you a CD if that helps.
Oh, burn. I know it has a new meaning.
Yes,
right?
I know. Right. Send you a CD that has the particular audio on it.
I see. Well, this is pretty much the status of the typewriter at that time. And so, now there is a wonderful parallel. I admit once again that you're way ahead of me in your connections, and I had not made that connection between the essay and the story. But I absolutely see it now that you've given me the insight, because at the time of the rise of the typewriter, Conrad wouldn't have anything to do with it. It did seem to him a technology which would absolutely interfere, and he wrote himself that the hand and the ink and the paper. And at one point he said, I think I may have put this in the story, that every time he dipped his pen in ink, it left in the inkwell a piece of his flesh. Now, that is such a direct, palpable, fleshly image. You could not say that about a typewriter,
yeah,
that every time you typed on a typewriter, you left a piece of your flesh in its liquid, because it doesn't have any.
Yeah.
And
some would say that about computers too. There are those who still stubbornly persist on typewriters, or even by hand, and have
I write
else
by hand.
You
I'm
write
one
by
of
hand?
Those.
Okay,
yes,
okay.
I'm one of those.
Just not to take away from those folks. I think it's great to, you know. I mean, I know Marianne Wiggins also writes out her manuscripts by hand too,
mm-hmm,
and so there is something to that. You know.
Well, there is that feeling, you know, of that it comes directly from your fingers, that it actually flows out of your fingers. Though the sensation of writing on the computer is very airy, though. It seems it almost happens by itself. It's really I don't want to knock it. It's a marvelous machine, and I adore it. So.
Well, I mean, speaking of tech references, and this is entirely something I suspect you did not know about, but knew the language in the last story.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you know this, but that is actually the operating system upon which Linux, the open source software, which everybody wants to replace Windows, is actually modeled upon. I'm not sure if you knew this. But
extraordinary. I did not know.
So now it adds this added resonance if you're a complete geek reading this particular story.
Right.
I had to alert you to this. Uh-huh. But while we're on the subject of that, I think it's really fascinating that the concept of Nu is interesting. You have him describing it like, oh, well, he meant to evoke, you know, the African Nu wandering around. But this character, Uncle Simon, simply cannot look at it in a non-literal capacity. And that might very well be part of his problems, because I think Nu, I think, oh, brand new, or something along those lines. And I mean, and speaking of wordplay, I know I'm throwing a bunch of things at you, but the notion of, in actors, of the crossword writer. I couldn't help but basically take each of those syllables and split into two words, because she is rather cross in the way that she writes her words out in these strings of paper.
Oh, cross words. Oh, how fascinating. Right. I didn't think of that either. My goodness, what a reader you are. here I found a reader who knows more about the writer's internal processes than the writer does.
Well, let's talk about your internal processes. I mean, how much can you write in the dark? I mean, going back to this notion. You wrote a 1985 essay in which you basically declared that you agonized over each particular sentence. You could not write the next sentence until you got the previous sentence
right.
That
remains true. Yeah. That remains true. It's a dreadful thing because this is a very severe, strict, merciless rule. Suppose you're writing a piece of fiction, and you come, let's say, toward the end, and you want to have something happen. To make it happen, though, you would ordinarily have to plant something back at the beginning to support this occurrence that you're planning. I'm not permitted to do that. So I have to really enter some terrible zone of anguish and very fancy footwork in order to get what I'm after without going back to the beginning and being permitted to plant something to make it much more simple.
Yeah.
So it's very tough to have such rules imposed on oneself.
I'm curious when you started imposing this upon yourself. I mean, roughly when in your career did the slowness of the sentences start to begin?
I think from the beginning, I think that let's call it a born serious writer has reaches a maturity of style around age 17. And a very famous contemporary example of this is Allegra Goodman, who was around that age when she published her first story. I think she was just out of high school. It was called Variant Texts, and it was so mature. It was about intellectuals who were far beyond her in age and expertise, it would seem, and it was a totally mature story and a much more famous and more tragic example of an early maturation of style. Of course, it's Anne Frank. So, but I think that maturation of style occurs beginning at 17, and at that point, you are what you are. And John Updike has said a wonderful thing in relation to this. He says no matter what kind of sentence he would like to have come out of his mind, it always comes out a John Updike sentence. And I guess it's a kind of fingerprint. So there really was no beginning. I've always been, I think it has to do with a kind of, this is how I've thought about it, a kind of idleness, a very deep, deep laziness. I don't want to make drafts. I want to work and be done and I'm finished. Imagine if you were a writer of drafts, then you would have to do it all over again and maybe all over again and go back to the beginning again and again. And I also don't like to leave behind a sloppy trail.
Yeah. Interesting. So really it's a matter that sounds to me like a rather pragmatic decision upon your part. I'm wondering, though, if you have ever tried...
I think it's temperament mixed with...
Yeah.
I think the pragmatism is the alibi, and it's basically temperament.
I mean, I do some writing, and I'm the kind of writer where I need to have a deadline or else I can't get anything done. I mean, that's just because if I don't have a deadline... I mean, in this case, I can't imagine how you would... If you can't control the speed at which you put out the sentences, I mean, how do you meet deadlines or how do you get work done? I mean, I know that sometimes you will dabble with a bunch of novels, you'll put out a bunch of novels, and then there'll be a period of years where there'll be these novellas, and then there'll be another novel again. So I must ask you about how that, how you manage to manage things.
Yeah, well, for a long, long time, I was writing essays, and that would stop the fiction cold. And then I would have to return to a very cold text, and that was difficult. For a long, long time, essays were being solicited, and I would respond because the assignments were really so compelling. And I've just had that happen again now after swearing off writing nonfiction. I really had sworn off it. But I had an opportunity. Would you like to hear about it?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Because it is fascinating in itself. There was discovered at Columbia University, hidden in plain sight, a manuscript by Lionel Trilling.
Really?
We had thought that The Middle of the Journey was his one and only novel, and it turns out that it was not. There was another novel of 24 chapters and 150 pages, which he abandoned. So I had an opportunity to read that, write about it, think about Trilling as a novelist, lament somewhat, or lament in a serious way, the fact that I think he's very much in eclipse. People don't read it. Well, he's certainly not read. And I think that there's a generation now, possibly not you in yours because you are super literary, but there is a generation which has never heard of Lionel Trilling. Do you think that's right?
I think, you know, compared against Edmund Wilson, I think his reputation is in decline. There was the Library of America 2-volume set that was put out on Edmund Wilson, and this has dug up a lot of pro-Edmund Wilson sentiments. But yeah, I would agree with you that Trilling is also a fantastic critic and really needs his own set as well, I would think.
And I would agree. But I think there is this important difference. I don't think people seriously mock Edmund Wilson. There's a little bit of teasing about him. But Trilling has come to be deeply mocked now because of his, quote, moral realism, his moral seriousness. I mean, there's the reviewers who are flippant or cynical can't take him. I mean, despise him.
Yeah.
So I think there is that difference. I don't think Edmund Wilson is condemned or despised to this degree or at all.
Yeah, I would agree with you. In fact, I mean, there's this kind of sincerity in a lot of those types of critics. You know, Leslie Fiedler also has a similar love-hate relationship as well in terms of critical posterity. Mm. I mean, I find this very interesting that those critics out there who are just gushing with sincere love or appreciation of literature are often not considered serious critics because, if they're not knocking the books, how can they actually be doing criticism proper when, in fact, loving and being passionate about books and being open-minded about things like genre and the like, to me seems to be the responsibility of a critic as much as applying a very close scrutiny to the text.
But, I agree. That's right.
What was I going to ask?
By the way, this new novel, this new old novel of Trilling's, is remarkable, brilliant, and a total failure. And he must have known it because he quit. Yeah. So it's very sad. It's very sad to see this.
It seems to me there might have been an early optimism, perhaps, as there often is for texts along these lines.
But it followed the middle of the journey. It followed the other one. And when he was totally condemned for having dared to write, it was considered a kind of literary transvestism. How dare you essayist, how dare you cross this impermeable line and enter this zone where, even though you know everything about the novel, you know nothing about the novel because you can't practice it.
I wanted to go into a rather seemingly banal question, although I am very interested in your character names, particularly Frank Castle in Actors. This connotes to me multiple things. I think of Kafka's The Castle and the bureaucracy. I also think that by going to... And I'm sorry, I got the story wrong. It's at Finocchiaro, not Actors. He goes to Italy, and it struck me as if he's almost castling, as if in chess, while going to... So I wanted to ask you about the origin of this particular name, and I also have to ask you, also speaking of actors, Silkovitz. I love that name. I mean, it just completely epitomizes that character, and I wanted to ask you about these two names and how character names often come about.
I love the idea. Again, you've startled me by an astonishing insight about his castling, yes, as in chess. I actually took the name from the name of a German city called Kassel, Kassell. And I thought of it as I was musing about what his background might be. And I thought of this city as possibly an ancestral background for him. And since there were a lot of Jews who lived in that city before Hitler, I even wondered, though I never expressed it, I even wondered whether Frank Castle might be a converted Jew, because at the very start, I believe in the first paragraph, there's a statement that he had some Protestant acquaintances, but no Jews.
Yeah.
So there was that little this just a tiny little seed in the back of my mind. His excessive devotion to Catholicism, almost like a stranger, rather like somebody born to it, and that comes out in his encounter with Nightingale, who can be flippant about it because he is a cradle Catholic, as it's called. So I did have some sense of not unsureness. I wasn't unsure, but I some intended ambiguity about his view of his devotion at this conference.
I should, while we're talking about ambiguity, note the note that is at the end of the first story in which you essentially put this little annotation saying that, well, you know, I didn't get all the details entirely right, but that's not the purpose of fiction.
Yes.
Okay, so if fiction is about pretending, and in fact actors is also about pretending, and I'll go into that perhaps later, but I want to ask you about the idea of fiction as a pack of lies. It seems to me that you're not all that concerned, or that the historical truth doesn't matter, that you should favor ambiguity over being a stickler for the details. I mean, would you say that would be the kind of
MO? Oh, absolutely. You have to be a stickler, I think, when you're writing nonfiction. I mean, this is a responsibility, an obligation, an absolute commitment. But fiction is where you can play, and where you can, I think, also do wicked things, which you cannot do in life.
Yeah.
Essays are generally on the side of citizenship, not always. You can write a wicked essay for sure. But generally, you're sort of being a citizen when you're writing essays. And when you're writing stories, you can be a witch or a wizard or a wild animal.
But even citing literary entrails, which we mentioned before, you had no problem with telling the truth, so to speak, in that one, and really sticking to your guns and saying, this is what my thoughts are on the current literary climate. So I would argue that, well, you could almost be considered, particularly as I've seen the climate in the last 15 to 20 years, the idea of taking people to task in print has become almost cartoonish, the likes kind of practiced by Dale Peck's hatchet jobs, things like that. But I mean, it seems to me as if I don't entirely believe you, because I think you're sometimes just as forceful in your essays as you are wicked in your fiction.
Well, I was going to qualify and say that what disturbs me more than anything else in the world, because, well, let me backtrack for a moment.
Sure.
Essays tell the truth of the moment, but you know, life proceeds, and you're not always the same, and you may contradict yourself in a later essay enormously, as I have, contradict what you've written in an earlier essay. But what really disturbs me is because you write essays and fiction both, when the essays are used as a kind of yardstick and set against the fiction, and so that the fiction is interpreted in the light of the essays. This makes me furious. I really repudiate that because, as I say, you cannot apply citizenship to the writing of imaginative fiction.
But there's also this notion of if you write an essay, you are not permitted to change your mind. I think you're absolutely right. I know that.
There you are.
Yeah.
There you are. No, my personal rules about sentences in fiction is my own, you know, mishigas. In essays, you certainly are permitted to change your mind. I mean, I wrote something in 1970. If it were possible, like in Sleeping Beauty, where it isn't possible, you know, to call in all the spindles in the kingdom so the princess wouldn't get stuck with this, and then there's always one loose one. But if it were possible, really, to call in every essay, every printed version of that essay, and burn them up and never let them. This essay from 1970 has haunted me again and again, and I wrote it as a conceit.
Yeah.
And it has something to do with idolatry, and that the imaginative writer was in competition with the creator of the universe. And it was a conceit to make a sort of point. And it's been following me. So I read again and again, I am so concerned with idolatry. I'm afraid of fiction because it is idolatry, which seems to me, you know, just absolute ranting nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's a, you know, a specific explicit example of getting kicked by something you wrote a long time ago.
But you could always put it out in book form as, I'm thinking of, you know, the John Barth essay in which he basically declared all postmodernists, that's really the future of literature. I think it's called The Postmodern Imagination.
No, I should read that.
It's collected in the Friday book, because he wrote his nonfiction on Fridays.
Uh-huh.
But he actually has a little asterisk in his book, in the book version of it, and he says, did I really write this sentence in 1960, whatever? Mm-hmm. Indeed I did, dear reader, and indeed I felt this way. But if you want to see what my thoughts were later, you can turn to this letter
essay.
I read this, and in light of the current environment, I'm like, this is fantastic. Why can't we have this fluidity, you know, in today's essays, in today's nonfiction, and today's book coverage as well, you know?
Tell me what you mean by the current environment. Characterize it.
Essentially, I think that there is, in the current literary critical environment, there is a very, it's very friendly to James Wood and to... And I'm blanking out on the other realist literary critic for some reason, but I'm sure he'll come back to me.
Yes.
But this idea where we will only champion, Dan Mendelsohn, there we go.
Mm.
We'll only champion realist books. We're only going to keep our focus in on this. We're going to thumb our noses up at genre. We're going to thumb our noses up at anybody who does anything different. If we do review them, as James Wood reviewed Don DeLillo's book, Falling Man, the last one, we're going to criticize it for its prose. We're not going to recuse ourselves. We can't possibly change our minds because we feel this particular way. We will always feel this particular way. You know, God bless literature, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what I'm describing here. I can't remember what the actual thread of my question was, but I think this notion of putting a asterisk or a footnote to account for the changing of the mind or the changing of any one critic's mind. Do you have any particular thoughts on that? I may as well also ask you, I noticed that you haven't written for the New York Times Book Review since the end of 2006. So I'm wondering if that was a recusal upon your part because of this very reason? Or
I was offered another one and it was not the time for me because I was involved in the novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was being brave, you know. Even though it was a very short book, I was still being brave.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I could not resist the Lionel Trilling because I had sat in his seminar and there was this kind of relationship I had with him, not a strong one, but one that at one point simply astonished me. This is digressing a little bit, or turning back to what we spoke about before. Maybe I'm a little bit Trilling obsessed now because I've just finished this essay on the abandoned novel. But you know, he wrote a study, I believe the earliest or certainly one of the earliest full-length studies of E.M. Forster. And I had a letter from him some years later in which he said that homosexuality was not an issue in the culture at the time, and he had no notion whatever that this was a characterization of Forster. And I found that simply amazing, that because he was really a grown-up, you know, when he wrote this study of Forster. He'd already finished one on Matthew Arnold.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he was innocent in this way, and not understanding who Forster was.
Yeah.
And although it is true that at that time Forster had not yet published that novel, Maurice,
yeah,
at that point. But it is that interested me. So
switching complete tacks altogether, I have to ask you this question. In these stories, there are actually a lot of descriptive references to Nex. This was very interesting to me. I can
to
actually
what?
Say
to what?
Nex. As in necks on the body. You describe Francis's neck as long.
Oh, neck. Neck. The
yes.
Human neck.
The
oh.
Human neck.
Oh.
No, you describe Francis's neck as long, thin, and imperious with a jumpy pulse at the side. And then of Miss Hallowes in Dictation, you write, she had a long neck, she was long all over. Now, this struck me as quite fascinating because in both of these instances, you're dealing with really long necks. And in fact, I've seen throughout your fiction work a lot of references to necks. Now,
I can make a particular observation
you
about
will.
This, about possibly comparing it to the head versus the body, that this is the great conduit between the two of them. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you your thoughts about necks and why they continue to pop up like this.
Okay, that I think this time I do have an answer. In the case of Miss Hallows, it's just literalism. I saw a picture of her, and I also read a little bit about her and learned that she was elongated everywhere, a very tall woman, and in her photo she's long-necked. So that was easy and simple. Now, with Frances and actors, I noticed necks when I was reading George Eliot years and years ago. George Eliot is obsessed with necks in this way. She has characters twisting, the women characters, young women characters, constantly twisting their necks. And I think it means something, because when we turn our heads, we're either turning toward or away. So it's either an act of evasion or, let's say, attention or eager attention. So the neck really has to do, it's in a sense, it is a symptom, not a source, but a symptom of consciousness, whether you are running from or running toward. And that's the meaning of the neck, because it's constantly on the move. Yeah. It never stays still.
Unless
you have a stiff neck.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting to me in light of the fact that you have Uncle Simon married to Essie, which evokes a sinuous curve, a twisting of the neck, possibly.
Yes, right.
I mean, that was another character name thing that crops up now that we mention it, but now it actually sort of... Now that we mentioned it, it actually ties into this character name idea, too.
Uh-huh.
Or this neck idea, too.
Yes, Essie, that's interesting. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, I never thought of that also. Do you write poetry?
No, I don't really write poetry. I do write fiction, but but I don't really write poetry.
No.
But I am a great lover of language.
Yes.
So I do find things. Oh, I actually wanted to ask you about something in relation to an interview you did with Robert Birnbaum. You said that you don't really leave the house much.
That's
and
true.
That this kind of figures into your writing. And reading these four stories, it struck me that, well, they're not really set in the present as we know it. They're either in the past or in the not-too-distant past.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask if this is what possibly prevents you, this hermetic nature, stops you from essentially writing work set in the present day, or whether you have more of an interest in, I mean, you know, if we are talking about write what you know, this is the obvious basic maxim, you know?
Mm. Yes, well, I think Actors is a contemporary story.
Yeah.
It is contemporary. The others certainly are not. And my friend and British agent David Miller told me recently, the next time you write a novel, you should put it in the present. I was much struck by his saying that, because when he said it, I hadn't realized, and he prepared me for hearing you say it, that my interest has been in the past. And in fact, the novel that I have underway now is set in the early 1950s. And so that is an interesting question for me. I don't know why I don't write about contemporary things in fiction. I do in essays, obviously, but I don't know the answer. I'm going to have to think about that. But, you know, staying home a lot and living inside your head makes it very hard to walk out. I emerged from a car, walked into where we're speaking now in a kind of internal fog, and it took me a little bit of time, you may have noticed, to be present here with you. I am fully present now.
Did you read on the way down, or did you get lost in your head, or what happened?
Lost in one's head, right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. I left behind me a rereading from pure self-indulgence, rereading of Sense and Sensibility, and I'm not quite finished with it. My head is somewhat there. That enormous wit. And this relates to the question about, you know, what is contemporary writing? You read Jane Austen. I know this is all trite to say, but it's so marvelous to think about and therefore not trite. You read Jane Austen and you know these people. You've met them all. They are purely contemporary. They are with us. You've seen them again and again. And so then what is the contemporary? Why is the 18th century in Jane Austen contemporary with us?
Yeah.
I guess because of the utter recognizable nature of human foibles. So in that sense, there is no past in fiction, in that sense.
It's interesting that you travel being lost in your head, whereas I have a tendency to travel and I think, oh, great, reading opportunity. I mean, I look forward to getting on the subway because it means an hour of reading. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to me. I have the same kind of circumstance as you, where if I enter into something, I will have to get my bearings and all that. Mm-hmm. But this is intriguing. I mean, it almost seems to suggest, going back to this idea of writing the next sentence, mm-hmm. that you really have to think about a book before you write it. I mean, what is your, and this may seem a kind of obvious question, mm-hmm. but what is your thinking to writing ratio?
That's interesting for me because one of my, my departures from the sense of how Trilling might have succeeded is too much knowledge. Knowing everything about a character beforehand, then you cannot let that character live and breathe. And I think novelists know that you cannot imagine a character. You have to allow a character to imagine him or herself, and that you cannot know beforehand. You can have an emotion or an idea, and I do think those things can very often be exactly the same thing. Ideas are emotions and emotions are ideas. Or you can have a scene in your mind or a character, but really you begin, I think, in complete and utter chaos and you don't know where you're going. For what I'm writing now, I had a simple thought which had to do with James's ambassadors, and I describe it, and this is about all I can say about it, is as the ambassadors in reverse. A young man whom everybody wants to come home and doesn't want to go home, to come home, and I wanted to reverse that, and I also wanted to make a comparison between Europe and America, but not in the Jamesian way at all, but in a contemporary way, well, contemporary in the sense of early 50s, namely post-catastrophe in Europe. I mean, James's Europe was the place of high culture and high civilization as compared with America. And my sense of it today is utter reversal, that it is, that it is Europe that is the negative and America that is not the negative, even though I know there's a lot of dispute about this point of view now.
Well, America is becoming increasingly negative, I would argue. But
well, in the view of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, right.
Well,
not in 1952.
That's true, not in 1952. Yeah. Well, I mean, this notion of what really is a contemporary novel? I mean, really, does it even matter where you set a particular book? I was talking with a young author, who's now written 4 books, and none of them have been set in the present age. Mm-hmm. Even though she has a very grand grasp of vernacular and description and all that, she phrased it in this way that, I mean, it's almost like this notion of like, well, Where was I going with this? I had about 6 different thoughts colliding with each other. I'm not sure if you had that problem.
Yeah,
but I mean,
do.
What really is contemporary to you? I mean, is it really fair to have your agent on the phone say, hey, Cynthia, you should really think about the present day when, you know, if it's relatively in recent time, I mean, if people who are alive today have lived during that time, I mean, is it even really an issue? I mean, human beings are, I mean, they're more or less similar. They're only really affected by changes in environment or changes in policy, perhaps. I don't know.
Well, look at Anna Karenina.
Yeah.
I mean, in contemporary society, there wouldn't be a story. She'd get divorced. That would be the end of it.
Yeah.
I think more interestingly than that, because that's too easy, is something more complex, and that is Forster's A Passage to India. The politics is obsolete. It's completely dead. It is a political novel, but it is so much more, and it lasts, and to my mind, is one of the greatest novels of the 20th century and very contemporary with us, in spite of the fact that India is independent and every time the phone rings, it's somebody calling from India these days with a marketing call. But that book with the Marabar Caves and Esmiss Moore, Mrs. Moore turning into a goddess, I mean, that book is so much more than a political novel. And yet its politics resonates also today, even though the Indian problem of independence is finished, solved. So I think everything is contemporary.
Yeah.
In terms of literature, there is no then and there is no now. Then is always now in terms of literature. I can't think of an example that contradicts this.
Yeah.
Can you? I'm working on it right now. It's something that feels very dated. What feels very dated? I mean,
well,
we know.
If you were to read, like, say, a novel, one of the hot novels of the 80s, like by Bret Easton Ellis or like Bright Lights, Big City, because that was written in the present moment, even though I like both of their work, it has dated remarkably because now you're clinging to brand names, clinging to specific aspects of the now that are going to be obsolete in years from now. And maybe this is why, perhaps subconsciously, you pursue novels, like, because something has had time to be thought about, that there's a specific set manner of thinking about a particular decade. I mean, right now, for example, we're seeing a number of books come out about World War II that are rethinking the canon. I mean, Nicholson Baker had Human Smoke. There's another book coming out in September that
I've read the Roosevelt book? You're talking about Human Smoke?
Oh, it's Human Smoke, too,
No, I've read that book.
But I mean, I think, though, that thinking about a particular time or a particular event, there needs to be some period of time, and maybe this might be why you pursue a particular...
No, but you know, the brand name things, they date things because there are things that happen. I'll go back to an early novel by Forster called The Longest Journey, in which they are in what today we would call exurbia, but they can look across the fields, and Forster says the red rust, meaning the brick houses, the red rust of London was creeping toward them.
Yeah.
Now, if you go to that place today, the red rust has taken over, and in fact with glass skyscrapers, and it's all part of London. And now that's like a brand name. It doesn't, because it's so of its time, it's so topical, and it's utterly changed since, that doesn't despoil or undercut the novel. I think it has to do with the power of the writer, and maybe it has to do with maybe it's trivia that dates.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the core of it, the seed. And maybe it's, if as a writer you're devoted to trivia, then trivia dates, but not, well, that's...
Not human. Human emotion is timeless.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, I wanted to talk to you. I mean, you were alluding to the fact that in Ann Fumicaro, Frank, you were suggesting that he may actually be a former Jew who has gone Catholic.
Mm.
Likewise, in actors, Matt Sorley's original name, we're informed, is Mo Sadaka.
Mm.
And that story struck me as being this fascinating idea of a man whose occupation is a pretender, who is in total denial about his real identity, and who can't even embrace the Yiddish theater with this wonderful over-the-top energy. But it also struck me reading this story that here you are, we were talking about this earlier, essentially a professional pretender writing this story, so that you are pretending about pretending. So I'm wondering, given this conundrum, if you want to get meta here, you know, whether this cancels it cancels everything out and creates a kind of truth, or maybe you can talk about this idea of these nested layers like this, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, I love meta. That's right. meta. Well, oh, hi, hello.
We'll wrap up like 5:10. Is that okay? We'll figure out a way to wrap. I didn't realize we were talking so long. So.
I didn't either. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Yeah, I'm really enjoying your mind, and because it keeps startling me. So it's a wonderful.
I've had people say that in a negative context.
So. Oh, this is positively positive.
But this notion of meta, just I want to just talk about yeah. here on this.
But isn't all writing a kind of meta act, because it's always impersonating, except that it's multiply impersonating, which is something that James says to Conrad in the story called Dictation, when they're arguing about is style the man, is man the style, and Conrad says only one thing all the time, and James says, but there are multiple personalities, and I do think this is so. So it's always a question of impersonating, and it's, I guess writing is in that sense like acting, with the difference that the actor has just one person to impersonate, and the novelist, the fiction writer, has an infinite number. Yeah. It goes on and on. There are so many impersonations, and that is really the delight of it, because what one is too timid or unable to do in one's own life, you can do just in make believe.
Yeah. Is this why you have the nonfiction to essentially anchor your reality, to write with a certain manner of reality, and to write through a prismatic aspect of reality, such as the fiction?
Yes. Well, the fiction. Well, that's the old cliche, the lie in order to tell the truth. And even though it is a cliche, it is a truth. It is the truth of fiction.
How many truths do you need as a writer? I mean, if we were to go ahead and do a canvassing campaign and actually sort of count the truths here, how many truths do you operate by as a writer?
I would say they're really, it's an infinitude. There's no end to what comes up in the imagination. I think meeting you and being startled by some of your views feeds into it. And for all I know, I will go home and find you a character when I get back to my desk.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Because it'll be a wicked tale. Actually, that's a great honor, I must say. I know you have to get going, Cynthia, but we'll have to do this again at some point. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was wonderful. Thank you. Truly wonderful.